How shall we define personhood and gender? How shall we define personhood and gender? This morning at the close of the service, I won't say his name because I didn't check. A young man came up, talked to me right about here. Talked about the school he attends. And I forget whether he said the past week or the week before, but he was just sharing with me. It was gay appreciation. Some things that were said and talked about in his school, and I guess because of the series, he thought I would be interested in that. And then he halted a bit, and you could see the awkwardness on his face. And this is what he said. I won't say the school he told me, but it's right in our area, where the washrooms for that week were made gender neutral. And you could see it on his face. Just how awkward he felt. This poor little guy, even just talking about it. I say that only to say that these things aren't like miles away on another planet. That the subject, when we started this series, I said, if you're in here and you have little children and you keep them in the service with you, it's a free country and I can't tell you what to do, but I'm not comfortable having little kids in here. Just the things that I want to talk about, even tonight. I try to be tasteful, but I still want to be specific. And so, again, just so you know that up front. How should we define personhood and gender? And I hope by the time we're done, you'll see why it matters. Because it's changing. In Jonathan Parnell's March 2013 blog posting, entitled More Than Body Parts, he charts the unfolding story of a boy in Colorado with male genitals who was prohibited from using the girls' bathroom. And this was upsetting to Donna Rose, who is a transsexual journalist writing her opinion for CNN. Rose writes, quote, "This six-year-old girl knows she's a girl. She dresses as a girl. Her legal documents recognize her as a girl. Her parents accept her as a girl. On the playground, you'd have difficulty identifying her as different from any of the other girls because in all ways that matter, socially and legally, this child is a girl." According to ABC News, the parents say that when the child was, get this, when the child was 18 months old, he began to struggle with gender identification. Just think about that one for a minute and how you measure that in an 18-month-old child. Later, in short, he played with Barbie dolls, said he wanted to be a girl, so mom and dad took him to a specialist who diagnosed him with gender identity disorder, and that was that. Gender identity disorder. I want you to think about that for a minute. Now, there have always been sexual deviations and distortions. There have always been feminine men and masculine women. That's not really a news flash. This isn't that. There's something commonly happening today that is an absolute first on planet Earth. For the very first time in the entirety of recorded history, people are being defined by the desires they have inwardly. People are being defined by the desires they have inwardly, sexual and otherwise. People are what they are oriented toward. This is the new definition of personhood, and it changes everything. Up until recently, upon billions of births, doctor would slap that newborn entity on the backside, listen for the cry, and exclaim, "It's a boy. It's a girl." And anatomical gender was personhood. And that person was identified by that maleness or femaleness until death. Now, transgender sexuality isn't the topic of this series. I get that. I'm starting here because the issue of defining people by inward desire, all right, he said he wanted to be a girl. This issue of defining people by inward desire is directly related to the issue of homosexuality and same-sex intercourse. Because just as people are now identified as male or female by inward inclination rather than outward anatomy, so homosexuality defines the entire person by inward desire and orientation. Point number one. And you'll see that I'm backing up the bus now and looking at a bigger picture, stepping back a little bit. The church must find ways of reaching out with compassion without fueling deeper bondage and devastation. Everything I say in this point is based on a certain conviction I have, and the conviction is that whenever the Bible addresses any issue of human fallenness, any issue of human fallenness, its message almost always feels sterner than our natural inclinations would choose at first. And that's because God's revelation always comes with the long-term goal of two things. The long-term goal of bringing out first a depth of personal repentance, and secondly, and I've talked about this at length if you've been attending the series, and second, God's revelation is designed to bring about this broader goal of an awareness of the depth of the ongoing effects of the fall and original sin on everyone in this room. On every one of us, we all push against the effects of original sin in our beings, and we will do so until Jesus comes again. So the divine goal of this initially stern revelation is to alert we careless sinners of the need of ongoing trust in our redemptive God, rather than the fluctuating standards of what is socially acceptable or socially unacceptable, because those things have changed. In my lifetime, those things have changed. And you haven't seen the end of it yet. Now, what that also means is the Bible usually looks sterner at first and more gracious in the end. And what that means is those who don't press biblical absolutes will always look kinder at first, but with the net effect of increasing deeper bondage and judgment eternally. Everybody see the difference in those two things that I just said? It's really important. Short-term tolerance of sin is about as compassionate as short-term acceptance of a growing tumor. I say this because many Christians simply know the list of verses against all sorts of sexual sins without having a firm grip on why God's uncompromising approach is so necessary and ultimately loving. And a lot of Christians are intimidated to trust the truth of God's word to actually be best for the sinner, even when it seems to be sterner at first than we would like. Either with much thought or with very little, a lot of the church has bought into the view, the now fairly commonly held view, that same-sex desires or same-sex orientation define the entire person. I hear it all the time. I hear it all the time from concerned people, even in this church, as they describe some cherished friend who feels the loneliness of his or her same-sex desires. And they'll say, but Pastor Don, you don't understand. That's who he is. That's who she is. And we've spent 2 weeks on that. But the phrase says it all. The person is defined by his or her sexual desires. And immediately a sense of tolerance and innocence just descends upon the discussion. After all, how can you blame anyone for being who he is? Who anyone is, well, that would be God's doing. I have no interest at all in being religiously hard-nosed or prudishly uncompassionate. But I think there's a question that at least needs to be addressed, as awkward as it is. Where does this reasoning process, this apparently more accepting, tolerant logic, the person is what they desire, where does that logic take us down the road? What I'm getting at is, if the homosexual is defined by his or her desires, if that's just who he or she is, what other desires can be given the same person-defining status? Are there others? It's not a hypothetical question. Monday, December 23rd, 2013, Toronto Star carries an article in its Insight column entitled, "Is Pedophilia a Sexual Orientation?" And the byline under Dr. James Cantor of the Center of Addiction and Mental Health reads, quote, "Dr. James Cantor has spent the last decade on research suggesting that pedophilia is a deep-rooted, unchangeable predisposition." The first paragraph of the article continues, quote, "Pedophilia has been widely viewed as a psychological disorder triggered by early childhood trauma. Now, many experts see it as a biologically rooted condition that does not change. Note, like a sexual orientation. Thanks largely to a decade of research by Dr. James Cantor at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health." Okay, that's just the beginning. Also included in the Toronto Star, postings of pedophiles themselves, anonymous postings, and here's what some of them said, quote, "It should be clear to anyone with gray matter that pedophilia is just another oppressed sexual orientation or interest. And age doesn't somehow magically make consensual sex between two people into something evil." Or, quote, "Nobody will ever quite understand the pain that we feel, seeing and longing for something we love but cannot have. And if we reach for it, we are accused of being sadistic monsters who only want to hurt kids. It will not last forever. Things will change." Now, remember those last two sentences. There's a reason for doing this. I want to get to it. It's not just to shock you or make you go, oh, man. That's not the point. Those last two sentences, "it will not last forever," that's the discrimination against pedophiles, "things will change." And I'm sorry, but that's the one part of the quote I totally agree with. Sadly, I believe it is an absolutely true statement that the current abhorrence with pedophilia won't last much longer. And yes, things will change horrifically for the worse. And the reason, now we're getting to the point, okay? And the reason such an insidious change is inevitable is bound up in the logic of defining persons by the orientations inside those persons rather than the actions of those persons. Everybody get it? Hello? Okay, good. Just Now, I understand. I understand the objector who would point out the world of difference between consensual same-sex intercourse between two adult persons and the abusive, coercive sexual exploitation of a child by an adult. I get it. Those aren't the same thing. That's true as far as it goes, but it misses the point. Because what those pedophiles are arguing for was the lowering of the age of sexual consent. That's their point. Their point is, listen, their point is there's no logical reason for discriminating against the inner orientation of those who genuinely love younger partners, as long as those partners, perhaps 12 or 13 years of age, can legally consent to those same desires. Then they're saying there is no difference now. I deeply hope you're not missing the main point. The point isn't to shock you with talk about pedophilia, nor is it to irritate the gay community by linking them with some criminal element. None of that is my point. I know most of us would feel there is no way most homosexuals would engage in same-sex intercourse who would even consider tolerating granting those kinds of rights to pedophiles. I know that. There is a difference. And I get it. Most of society still feels a certain inward revulsion toward pedophilia. Right now. The problem is, personal moral absolutes can be quite visceral, strongly felt, and undefined. Moral revulsion toward any act can evaporate in one generation. Feelings of compassion or revulsion, they're pretty fickle moral measuring sticks. It's quite another thing to move beyond our own moral revulsions as to what society accepts now or doesn't accept yet. It's quite another thing to move beyond that and offer a cogent, specific, fixed moral standard for society at large. We need to offer a reason for saying, yes, there is legitimacy to sexual orientation being consensually fulfilled on the basis of gender, but no, there is no legitimacy to sexual orientation being consensually fulfilled on the basis of age. And I'm arguing tonight that there's no credible way to sustain that moral ground for very long. Everybody understand what I'm saying? I doubt very much there will long be held a universally acknowledged stopping point for consensual expression of a myriad of inward sexual inclinations. And that's because once sexual desires become the entire inward person, then we no longer have the right to separate those desires out again and pronounce them sinful or wrong. We've already granted the desires are merely what the person is, and you can't put that cat back into the bag once you let it out. In trying to be loving and non-judgmental, we got more than we bargained for, and we got more than we can eventually live with. That's enough to give everybody enough to think about for all week, and I apologize to keep going, but otherwise we'll be here for the next 30 years. Point number two. In case you haven't heard about this, physical anatomy, brain gender, and how we got here. Carl Henrik Ulrich was one of the early sexual reformers of the 19th century in Germany, and he defined himself as a female soul confined in a male body. Only he was one of the first to say it. And that Ulrich is a significant figure in the gay community is borne out the title of Hubert Kennedy's book, Carl Henrik Ulrich, pioneer of the modern gay movement. This is a significant name. His was the thinking that has paved the way for the now common terminology and theory of what's called brain gender. It's not as complicated as it seems. Once the concept of homosexuality as an orientation, not an act, but an orientation defining the person, once that took hold, it transformed the whole discussion of human gender and personhood. Accordingly, in much modern discussion, each person is multi-defined. And let me just give you an example. First, there is obviously biological sex. That's determined by one's physical anatomy. Second, there's also gender identity. This has also become known as brain gender. This is measured as masculine or feminine based on a combination of factors such as how a person talks, dresses, behaves, as measured by the observed and tracked norms of society. Whether this person who is masculine is typically masculine as measured against other men, and whether this woman is typically feminine measured by traits against other women. That last sentence is very important. Third, there's also a person's sexual orientation. That's different. This is based as either heterosexual, homosexual, or bisexual, based on the individual's sexual attraction. Now, the implications of this are pretty complex. The whole person can be identified in different ways, depending on which factors are given priority. A person could have the body of a man, defining his biological sex. He could have the brain of a woman, defining his gender identity, and the sexual orientation toward both, defining himself as bisexual. One person. And you can't help but notice how different that is from the biblical account in which God created persons as male and female. I'm not studying this text tonight. We'll get into it in detail. But just to look at Genesis 1, 26 and 27... Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heaven, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And so God created man in his own image. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. That's the money verse. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So in the unfallen order of God's creation, before the domination of original sin and the disorientation of God's good creation, this is how personhood and gender is permanently defined. So just as the nature of the triune God is found in sameness yet diversity, let us make man in our image and our likeness. You have this Trinitarian reference, the persons in the Trinity, the one God, but not the same. In the same way, the nature of mankind is expressed in sameness, let us make man, and yet also diversity, male and female, he created them. And don't miss the central point of the passage. There is a purpose in the mind of God when humanity is created. It's in that 27th verse that I read three times. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So human persons aren't just made willy-nilly. They're fearfully and wonderfully made. Men are fearfully made. Women are wonderfully made. That's the way God did it. I'm sorry. That's not really in the text. They aren't just made willy-nilly. There's an intentional design in their personhood. They are made to point to the nature of something other than themselves. God says it twice. In our image. In our likeness. In our image. So their created design compares to God. Their nature says here. This is something like God himself. And then the text takes it a step farther. God defines the nature of this likeness. Like the Trinity itself, there is defined sameness and defined diversity. The maleness and the femaleness of the one created humanity reflect the oneness and the plurality of the Godhead. Let us, 26, make man in our image and our likeness. My point here is the whole design of creation argues against defining personhood in any other terms other than male and female. Just as God's creative rights are discriminated against when personhood is defined by sexual orientation, so his rights are discriminated against when personhood is defined in terms of brain gender or behavioral characteristics. Now, we don't have much more to go, so you've done real well. We're closing in. We're circling the wagons, and we're wrapping up. Let me just be clear. John Gray's bestseller, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, is only one example of the trend to track observed gender differences. It's become popular even in Christian circles to examine marriage issues along this line as well. And that's okay. I'm not fighting that. It's fine up to a point, but only up to a point. It's very important that we all remember what we're doing here. We are examining mere generalizations. We are simply looking at the way things often seem to be in the different genders. But that's all we're doing. We're only looking at what usually is typical in many situations. But that's not the same as definitively identifying what maleness is and what femaleness is. We don't use these generalizations to override anatomically created males and females. Did everybody understand what I just said? And I want to close by reminding you why this is so important. It has everything to do with the process used to, I believe, reinforce homosexual diagnosis and identity. In an article entitled Homosexuality, listen, this is out of the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender, Queer Encyclopedia. An article entitled Homosexuality identifies homosexuality based on, quote, this is out of their publications, the simultaneous incidence of same-sex orientation, okay, that's the desire, and gender role nonconformity. That's the measuring the traits, how masculine, how feminine. Now, please don't miss that second point. Part of the process, by their admission, part of the process of defining homosexuality is gender role nonconformity. That means they tabulate the generalized traits that appear to be more in common with men and those that appear to be more in common with women, and they use that statistical data to help define homosexuality simply based on how people fit those statistical norms. And here's what that means. When new categories are introduced to define personhood and gender beyond the created order of male and female, here's the problem. Sensitive men are instantly less masculine. Emotionally strong women are instantly less feminine. That kind of blatant discrimination ought to be offensive to everyone, Christians and atheists alike. But even more important, we end up not only describing, this is where I want to end up, we end up not only describing homosexuality, but prescribing it to any who don't fit the men are from Mars, women are from Venus categories. Please tell me you understood that sentence. It's not just describing it, it's prescribing it to people who don't fit the men are from Mars, women are from Venus categories. People with any degree of turmoil or angst over their sexual identity are given fresh encouragement to identify themselves as homosexuals simply by those statistics and nothing else. And so I wrap up with the story of Jacob and Esau. If there was ever a biblical warning about the danger of gender categories, it's here. Esau is a Mars man. He is rugged. He is a hunter. He is even physically different from his very smooth-skinned brother Jacob. Jacob liked to work in the kitchen. Now, that's no big deal anymore. But back then, kitchen was woman's work. Jacob resisted the outdoors. He hated the violence and the smell of hunting. Esau is from Mars. Jacob is from Venus. My point is, I wonder, given our new categories of defining genderhood, I wonder how Jacob would have been counseled in a modern school's guidance office. Do you get where I'm going? And yet we know from Jacob's infatuation with Rachel's physical beauty, his fathering of 12 sons, and his numerous dalliances with various concubines, in addition to his two wives, he was nothing less than rather overtly heterosexual. No, there's a definite plan afoot in multiplying the definitions of gender and personhood beyond the created order of male and female, by defining sexual desire and gender characteristics as the person himself. It is now impossible to make any moral pronouncements about homosexuality without being accused of not loving the person. We are intolerant and we are unloving by default before the discussion even begins. And I'm telling you, that was the plan all along. The new categories are designed not just to define homosexuality, but to promote it. And I think Christians need to see that distinction and recognize that difference. I know that's not a typical Sunday night sermonette that leaves everyone leaving the sanctuary shouting hallelujah. We need to know what's going on in this ball game. Like, we need to understand, and we need to be able to bring a compassionate biblical mindset to it. And everyone said,